welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman. And for those of you who may have joined just now, my guest this week is Nigel Gould-Davies. He's the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And Nigel has a great deal of experience as a diplomat in the region. He was British Ambassador to Belarus from 2007 to 2009, and has also been the head of the economic section at the British Embassy in Moscow. So thanks again for joining me today, Nigel.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I'm glad you could be here. And I think the timing is really fortunate because, as I mentioned, you had an opinion article published in the New York Times last week on May 12th, I believe. And I want to kind of follow up on some of the points you made and how they fit into the situation on the ground, as they say. With Russia's offensives in eastern Ukraine facing a major challenge, by most accounts, certainly, from Ukrainian forces in the Donbass, around Kharkiv for the north, and elsewhere, elsewhere in Ukraine. The title of your guest essay was, "We Must Make Sure Russia Finishes This War in a Worse Position Than Before." You know, I think that's something that people are starting to talk about more and more lately. And I'm just going to read an excerpt from the article, Nigel. You wrote, quote, "The West needs a strategy that guarantees Russia will end up regretting its actions. A peace that for the second time since 2014 rewards a Russian invasion with Ukrainian territory would have severe consequences for Ukraine's future, Western security and credibility, and the norms of sovereignty and non-intervention that underpin the international order." You went on to wait for a grueling stalemate to define the contours of a peace settlement is to favor Russia. To prevent this from happening, the West needs to guarantee that Russia is worse off than it was before the invasion. At a minimum, Western policy should ensure that Russia gains no new Ukrainian territory and continues to face severe sanctions until it fundamentally changes its policy toward Ukraine," unquote. So thanks for bearing with me on that. And Nigel, my basic question here is, how can this be done? What would the West need to do to try to guarantee that Russia is actually worse off than it was before the invasion? And do you think it's feasible? Can it be done?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks to everyone who's pointing out questions as well, if we have time for those. So just a bit of context to this, just to convey a sense of how I was thinking about this. The West is not a combatant in this war, but it is a participant. And it's the most powerful of the participants, ultimately. The resources it has to bring to bear on this conflict outstrip Russia's. And it seems to me it's the only participant that hasn't clearly defined objectives. It's chosen means, but not yet ends to which it wishes to direct those means. The means are well known, of course, principally the provision of military aid, intelligence as well, and also severe and growing economic sanctions, which I believe will have very, very significant and cumulative effects on the Russian economy. This reminds us, incidentally, this is a war being fought in effect on two fronts. One is on the ground in Ukraine by military means, and the other is on the home fronts of the respective participants, and that's by economic means. So I do believe it's absolutely essential for a range of reasons for Russia to be left worse off than this. The alternative to that would be that Russia is better off as a consequence of what we now have to call the second invasion of Ukraine following the first one in 2014. And that would be a victory for Russia, even if the outcome fell short of its primary objectives of forcing a change of regime and the imposition of a, a pro-Russian puppet government in Kiev. It would be a vindication of the horrific methods as well that Russia has used to prosecute the war and persecute civilians. So I do believe for all those reasons, it's essential that Russia be worse off. What does worse off mean exactly? Well, that's something that we can discuss, and there's a range of possibilities there. At a minimum, I would say it means that Russia can enjoy no net territorial gain beyond what it possessed control over on February 24th, when the invasion began. It could mean that Russia loses control of some or possibly even all of the territories that it acquired since 2014. And maybe we can talk about some of those scenarios a little later. If it's a matter of, in territorial terms, simply becoming no better off but not becoming worse off, then I think it's essential that sanctions continue and continue to exert those cumulative and erosive and severe effects on Russia's home front. That would help make Russia worse off and also make it clear the price that it would have to pay until it fundamentally changes its attitude towards Ukraine and Western security, I have to say, more generally. So can it be done? Well, it's partly a matter of the resolve and the scale of support that the West is prepared to provide to Ukraine, and partly a matter of Ukraine's own capacity to continue to fight, and we have to say now increasingly win, because its gains even in the past few days seem to me quite remarkable. Ukraine has done the hard bit. It's saved its capital. It has forced Russia to very significantly downgrade at least its shorter-term objectives. I do not believe that Putin will ever give up the aspiration and principle for those maximalist goals that he had set himself at the beginning of the war. Ukraine, at great cost to itself, has done the hard things. The West now can and should do the easier ones. And if Ukraine continues to win on the field, or at least continues not to lose, then if the West does escalate the forms of support it's been providing already, then the correlation of forces will gradually and inexorably shift in favor of Ukraine. So I believe, yes, it absolutely can be done. But it's essential the West set itself unambiguously the goal of doing that, of making Russia worse off after and as a consequence of this war. Now, we've seen a number of statements from Western leaders that suggest a more explicit and firmer sort of direction of travel in the last few weeks. There was Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's remarks about making Russia weaker. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss saying in her Mansion House speech that we should go further and farther until Russia is pushed out of Ukraine. We saw Ursula von der Leyen say that we want Ukraine to win. But I don't think we have a Western consensus yet that's explicit on this matter. And that's what we need now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Interesting points you make. One thing I'd like to just mention is, it seems like there's been movement definitely in that direction, as you say, you know, and there's still a lot of debate in the West over, you're saying, you know, this should be made kind of a policy and a concerted one, a concerted effort by the West. And there's also, still debate over, you know, whether it's a good idea to kind of punish Russia, whether, you know, some people would oppose the idea of Russia ending up with less than it has now, or that it's taken, or that it had before February 24th when it invaded. Another thing it was very interesting you mentioned, and I think this has sort of been a little bit forgotten. You mentioned that Russia needs to change its attitude. I'm not using your exact words, but I guess change its attitudes toward Ukraine. and also towards Western security, I guess. And that's, you know, that's sort of a fundamental thing. I mean, for me, it seems like a long time ago, but in December, November, December, you know, Russia was making its, you know, incredible demands for, you know, no NATO expansion ever into Ukraine or other, you know, no countries in the former Soviet Union could join NATO, and rolling back, you know, NATO weapons in Eastern Europe, essentially kind of an effort to return to kind of unlose the Cold War in a way, really, to return to mm-hmm. you know, sometime in 1991. So I just thought, you know, it's interesting because people have sort of forgotten in some ways about, you know, those demands that were made. And that seemed to really presage, you know, as the invasion drew closer, it was kind of thinking, how can Russia not invade when it's making these demands and they're being rejected? So yeah, I just wanted to point that out. I guess the other... one of the other questions I'd have is, I'd just like to go back to the part of that excerpt from your essay. You wrote that at a minimum, Western policy should ensure that Russia gains no new Ukrainian territory. And you spoke about this in what you just said a bit and what that might mean. But I guess the question for me is, what if Russia loses territory? Not territory, you know, in Russia, but territory that it now controls in Ukraine. Personally, I kind of struggle to imagine Putin accepting an outcome that leaves him with no way to claim some measure of success. In other words, an outcome in which Russia not only does not gain any new territory, but actually loses control over the parts of the Donbass that it held before the invasion on February 24th. I think there's about a third of the Luhansk and Donetsk provinces, not much more than that. So I guess I struggle to believe, it's a big question for me, like if faced with that situation, would Putin refrain from taking some drastic and destructive step? I mean, a step even more drastic and destructive than those he's already taken since February. Nigel, you wrote that, quote, "The argument that Russia will use nuclear weapons unless it is allowed to gain from the war does not deter Ukraine from fighting, and it should not deter the West from giving Ukraine the means to do so," unquote. And you also wrote that, quote, "weakness does not make an irrational threat more credible." So I'd like to follow up on that and ask essentially this, and I'm going to leave Crimea out of it for now at least. Let's say Russia and the Russia-backed separatists or forces in the Donbass are essentially defeated and pushed out of the Donbass and out of the areas further southwest that they now control, at least partially. What happens next?
Yeah, now that's a very good question. So as I mentioned earlier, I think the single most important question, at least territorially, is whether Russia becomes better off or ends up worse off. But there is a secondary but also very important question, which in effect you've just posed, which is how much worse off? And of course, a range of possibilities. But to keep it simple, it could be either a matter of going back to the status quo ante, not of 24th of February this year, but of March 2014, so soon after the first invasion of Ukraine. And that would leave Ukraine now, if it were able to sort of return to the status quo ante then in March 2014, that would leave it with control over the whole of the Donbass, but not Crimea. And then the last possibility would be to return to the status quo ante of February 2014, before the rigged referendum in Crimea, and take the whole of restore the whole of Ukrainian territory. As you said, it maybe you can sort of park that for the moment. So how much further could Ukraine go now if it continues to win? And how far would Russia accept that? I suppose on the matter of acceptance, well, I mean, countries are just defeated. They don't necessarily accept the defeat. It's something that simply is a fact for them. But of course, you pose the possibility that a lot of people have been worrying about since the beginning of this war, of whether Russia might use nuclear weapons and break that through that that firebreak that's been observed ever since 1945. And much ink has been shed on the subject, of course, and there's a range of views. I'll just offer a couple of thoughts on this. So, I mean, firstly, I think it's important to, if Putin genuinely is kind of deranged and mad and either for obsessions about historical legacy or his own possibly imminent mortality or some combination of the two. If he really is, as it were, deranged in that way, then all bets are off. We simply can't make sort of calculations about what someone who's insane can possibly do. If there's rationality there, then rationality is something you can understand and work with. But you do that not on the basis of what they say, but on the basis of your best understanding of how they will really act. And from the start of this war, Putin has worked hard in various ways to raise the prospect, the specter of the use of nuclear weapons. This was more or less explicit in the speech that he gave declaring what he still won't call war, but is. And his loose nuclear talk, of course, has disconcerted people in recent years. He's the only leader of a major nuclear power who's ever talked as loosely and recklessly about nuclear weapons as this. Does it would be a profoundly unwelcome for him for Russia to lose territory it controls, but recall it's not sovereign Russian territory, it's still sovereign Ukrainian territory. The fact that it's unwelcome doesn't mean that he will resort to irrational means if he's still rational. He knows that the prospects for him could be absolutely disastrous. On the question of sovereignty, incidentally, we may well be faced with a scenario that I'm not sure there's any precedent for anywhere in the world, which is in the middle of a war to recognize territory or claim assert a sovereign right over territory that you've not held before. So it's very possible that in the next few days or weeks, rigged referenda will be held in various parts of Russian-controlled Ukraine, including the parts of the Donetsk and Luhansk so-called People's Republics. And by those means, Russia will try to integrate these territories into the Russian Federation, claiming that it now owns them, that they are sovereign parts. So that would mean if Russia did that, I'm very doubtful that any other country would recognize that claim, but Russia would assert them in a way it hasn't before as sovereign territory. And that would mean it would claim in its Russia's eyes that any advance of Ukrainian forces into Donetsk and Luhansk would be incursions into Russian territory. That's how they would try to portray the subject, and it's portray those actions. It's very important that that kind of claim be rejected. Of course, as you know, the Western intelligence community has been looking very, very closely, constantly is, at what Russia is doing and might be preparing to do with its nuclear forces, and sees no sign yet of any practical operational preparation for their use. I think it's important, and I try to argue in the article, it's important to kind of aim off or respond to those parts of the analytical community that have always placed the highest priority and made as their greatest concern the risk of escalation. And there are some people who have made this a consistent theme of their commentary. Before the invasion, they said, well, we have to pressure Ukraine into making concessions so that Russia won't invade. And then when the war began, they said, well, there's no point in providing military aid for Ukraine. Those would be over very quickly. Russia will win. And when Russia didn't win very quickly, then said, well, our priority must be to avoid escalation. So the concern in the minds of those analysts has always been, well, the most important thing is to avoid escalation. If you do that, if you make escalation, particularly by nuclear means, by your adversary, your greatest concern, then you invite escalation. You encourage it to take place. And I think that's it's very important to provide a corrective to that view. The risk isn't zero. We're in genuinely uncharted territory. And I wouldn't want to offer any false assurance that the risk of a nuclear escalation is zero, but it would remain a dangerous, risky, an irrational step. And we shouldn't exaggerate its probability, because if we do, then we cede to Russia, in effect, the right to decide what we do. There's one final issue in all of this, which I think has been neglected to a degree. I did not mention my article, but it's worth raising. China would be, which I think is already very disconcerted for a large number of reasons by this war, which has made Russia a reckless, unreliable, and much weaker partner, and has mobilized Western power and sanctions instruments in ways that could, in due course, be used against China. I think China could not conceivably support the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. So to the extent that that relationship matters to Russia, I think that will also be a restraining force on it.
That's a very interesting point that I hadn't thought of, along with some of your other points. So I'd just like to, so that's another factor kind of restraining Russia from using nuclear weapons. And one thing I'd also point out is that, well, as you said, I think, I guess Western countries and intelligence services have not detected any meaningful change in, I guess, what is it, the posture, but of Russia in terms of nuclear weapons since the start of the invasion, and since Putin, I guess, asked Shoigu, ordered Shoigu, the defense minister, to put the nuclear weapons on a special kind of alert. So that may not have actually meant anything. And that sort of plays into the idea that, you know, a lot of this is rhetoric. And Putin has been making comments about, you know, he's been, as you said, raising this kind of the threat, the idea of the possible use of nuclear weapons for years now, since before this invasion. He was talking about, you know, who will go to heaven and who will go to hell if there's a nuclear war a few years ago. It's kind of a theme that he seems to like to play on. You have Lavrov doing that as well now, and others in Russia. I just want to ask one other question, and actually get into the idea of Crimea for a minute. I think, you know, recently there's been more talk, as we mentioned, about the idea that Ukraine can win the war. I think there's I would venture to say that there's more of or confidence or more of a, you know, I at least hear Ukrainian voices saying, well, you know, we will take back Crimea. Do you think that's sort of a possibility here, or is that still something that's, I mean, in terms of militarily and kind of politically in the West, or is it something that that will be shied away from? I don't know. Maybe it's a sensitive question.
I mean, the first thing to say is that, just as sort of a larger contextual point, we focused on how sort of what would happen to territory at the end of the war and what would be agreed in the course of some eventual peace agreement. Who controls what territory, of course, is a very important question. It's not the only question that would be relevant to the form of a peace agreement. There are other issues as well, and one of them is the fate of the nearly 200,000 Ukrainian citizens who have been taken, in effect, forced, abducted, if you like, and are now in various parts scattered across the Russian Federation, some as far as Kamchatka in the Far East. There are others too. A second issue, more directly for the West, is under what terms would sanctions be eased? And a third issue is what form of reparations might be made for the devastation that Ukraine has suffered from this war? And is there a relationship between the sanctions question and the reparations question? Active discussions on both sides of the Atlantic now in explorations and ways to not just to freeze assets, but to seize them and to help them contribute to the eventual revival of Ukraine's economy. There are other issues as well. The question of the prosecution of war crimes, which is a large international legal issue, presumably would not be affected by a peace agreement. But to go back to the specifics of territory, the West, I imagine, will never formally recognize the annexation of Crimea, unless Ukraine says, well, that's a price it's prepared to pay for an outcome that on other terms would be advantageous to it. Just as the annexation of the Baltic states by the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War was never formally recognized by the West. There may be another issue here about the views of the local population. I just don't know how this would work out, and it's a difficult speculation. So if it's a matter of fighting on territory where at least a proportion of the people don't want the status quo to change, well, that raises questions that haven't been raised so far by the fighting that Ukraine has done, because that's been among a population that absolutely supports what the Ukrainian military is doing and what it's fighting for. So I think everyone recognizes Crimea as the most difficult of the issues to be broached. What's quite clear at this point is that under international law, it remains part of Ukraine's sovereign territory.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Those are really, I mean, I think you sort of provided both kind of sweeping, look at the situation, and also a lot of great detail about, and thanks for raising those additional issues that will be involved in the future in any kind of a agreement or negotiations, including the reparations and the, as you mentioned, 200,000 Ukrainians or so who have been taken to Russia or given no choice but to go there, and are living in different and difficult circumstances there. Obviously, kind of a huge question among other ones, as you mentioned. So thanks for raising that as well. And we're getting short of time, but I'd like to take a few questions, if there are any. I see we have one question from Nirvana Mahmoud. Can you go ahead and ask, please? She may not be on the podcast anymore, so I'll just open it up. If anyone else has questions, for Nigel. Please go ahead. Or you can, and you can ask to be a speaker and or send a DM.
If we're waiting, Steve, could I just make an additional point here?
Absolutely, yes.
So yeah, I just want to go to the point about China, because as I mentioned, it's hard to imagine that China could possibly approve the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And there's a larger point. There are some people that still think, well, the war in Ukraine is a sort of distraction, and you know the West should focus on China, which is the more sort of compelling, longer-term rising threat. But I think that's the wrong way around to look at it. So, and the way to see that is to ask the question, what would be better for the Sino-Russian relationship and potential full-blown alliance? What would help that? Would it be a Russian victory or a Russian defeat? And it seems to me it's quite clear that what would help the Sino-Russian relationship would be a Russian victory, or at least Russia being better off and prevailing in some way in this war. On the other hand, a Russian defeat that leaves it worse off, that exposes the limitations of Russia's power, and incidentally has created already, through Western sanctions, a host of economic problems for China. That's something that would weaken this closer relationship between China and Russia, what you've seen in recent years. So if you want to be, if you want to tackle the China challenge effectively, and you want to ensure it's less likely to have an effective partner that China has confidence in, then you must support Ukraine. That's the way to weaken the Sino-Russian relationship.
That's quite interesting, and I'm very far from being an expert on China in any way, but to me, kind of as a layman in this area, it's sort of ironic because as I see it, people were saying, you know, the Biden administration wants to have a stable Russia and not have problems with Russia because it wants to deal with China. But now in this situation, I think you're saying, you know, well, that is dealing with China. So so things have kind of turned around, I guess, or maybe they were always that way. But I will, looks like we have a question from Hector Espina. Can you ask, please? Sorry, Hector, if you want to ask a question, you're going to need to request request again to be a speaker. If not, we'll give it a few moments and move on. So does anybody else want to ask a question? Okay, I believe we have one from Samuel. Samuel Westerby. Sorry about my pronunciation.
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I have a question for Nigel, or I guess I have two questions for Nigel. One question is if you would care to elaborate due to his diplomatic background or previous diplomatic background, if you would care to elaborate on the Italian, French, and German rumored position, which came out in Politico, I think yesterday or today, with regards to these three countries preferring to have a peace agreement as opposed to a dragged out potential victory for Ukraine. I don't know if this was answered already, but if it was, then I apologize. But if it wasn't, then I'd be very curious to hear his opinion about that. And maybe to both, I mean, hear his analysis of it, but also to understand, as a former diplomat, what motivates them to say that. And then my second question would be, because I just saw that Nigel has put filmmaker in his bio, so I'd be genuinely quite curious to hear what would a great a documentary or a film script be, or a film idea be currently for potential filmmakers on the Ukraine crisis, in his opinion. Thank you.
Okay. I've not seen a political piece, but I will look for it after this this podcast. It sounds interesting. And if there's actually been discussions between the three countries you mentioned, Italy, France, and Germany, well, that's worth worth exploring. I mean, each of those countries individually has been sort of making a journey on the whole question of clarifying its position and therefore the objectives it seeks. As you know, Germany's undergone a historic and very significant shift in its foreign policy, which includes the provision of very significant weapons systems to Ukraine. This is a coalition government, of course. It's still, you know, working out its common position on this, and it's not of one mind, it seems to me. France, well, we'll see now Macron is safely re-elected, what position emerges in due course. But I, there is a sense, I've just been at the Lennart Meri conference here in Tallinn, and one of the kind of views that emerged from the 3 days of discussion here is just how far out of step it seems that President Macron is with respect to not only the larger European center of gravity, but also French domestic opinion as well. And this is a really, really interesting point about public opinion across the board, that where governments are more cautious about setting out a strong position or statement about what outcome they want to see from the war, they are lagging behind public opinion. And this is a large, it seems to me, really significant fact about Western unity. It's absolutely unprecedented across governments mostly, but more than that, Western opinion and even very large parts of the private sector as well, including companies that have invested in decades. In the case of Siemens, it's just announced its withdrawal centuries in Russia. We've not seen that kind of private sector boycott supporting official sanctions before. It's just remarkable. We never saw this degree of unity across states, societies, and markets, even in the darkest periods of the Cold War. Italy, too, has also been more alarmed than we might have assumed, I would say, given the extent of their earlier, especially commercial relationship with Russia. And that's partly a consequence of the war crimes we've seen, which I believe are at least as significant as the invasion itself in hardening Western opinion. And of course, we've just seen the Eurovision outcome, one more moment, a solidifying moment of solidarity. So I would be surprised, actually, at this point, if there were these three major continental European states were sort of concerting to try to lobby for some more moderate outcome. We have seen voices from the beginning of the war saying the most important thing is a ceasefire, as if stopping the war is a separate and more important question from ending the war on the right terms, on terms that serve Ukraine's and the West's interests. It's it seems to be generally not a helpful and not a thought through position to say the most important thing is to stop the war. No, the most important thing is an outcome that's right for Ukraine and serves the interests and values of the West as well. But I will look at the Politico piece on filmmaking. Well, that's just a sort of personal hobby. But this is a defining moment not only in Ukraine's history, potentially also in Russia's history as well, but a great moral and strategic moment, watershed really, for Europe too. So I fully expect in due course, art of all kinds and the creative imagination to flourish as a consequence of what we are seeing. There'll be extraordinary stories, among other things, of enormous heroism and bravery and self-sacrifice. Now's not the moment to make them, of course, but in due course and in a better time, I've no doubt there's lots to do there.
Well, that's that strikes me as that's kind of an apt comment, kind of bringing us back to really, sometimes it's hard to grasp the enormity of this, what's happening. And I think you've done that quite well just now. And at the same time, given some kind of a picture of optimism. And I'd like to also, you know, you mentioned, and I didn't mention this before, but I do think, you know, obviously the alleged war crimes, the atrocities that have been carried out, you know, I do think those clearly changed the picture of how people are reacting around the world. You know, it's not just, you know, it's things are changing because of the way Ukraine is defending itself, the West helping, but also because of some of the things that Russia has done and is doing in Ukraine. Sorry, it's hard to really explain what I'm trying to say, but I'll just open it up, I guess. Are there any other questions? Sorry, bear with me a minute. Okay, I see no other questions now. I'd like to wrap it up, but Nigel, if you want to make any parting comments, go ahead. Otherwise, I can wrap it up.
Just finally, just to reiterate the argument, the West has chosen its means, and they are escalating. It's not yet chosen its ends. There is movement in a harder and firmer direction, but we haven't reached a consensus yet. I hope we will. And I just on the matter of war crimes, I fear that in the coming weeks and months, what will be revealed about what has happened will be even worse, possibly much worse than what we know so far from Bucha, Irpin, Borodyanka, and other places too. And that will and should have its moral effects on Western public opinion, and therefore in due course on Western policy.
All right, let's wrap it up there. Nigel, thanks very much for joining me. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure, and thanks to everyone for joining.
All right, great to have you. Great insights. Now, once again, I've been speaking to Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and a lot of experience as a diplomat, former ambassador, British ambassador to Belarus, and head of the economic section of the British Embassy in Moscow. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast. You can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, I'm taking a break from this next week, but I'll be back with the next edition of The Week Ahead in Russia on May 30th. And the next edition of my newsletter, The Week in Russia, will be out on June 3rd. Thanks for listening.